Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
We had a very strange game that was called something like, oh God, I can't remember what it was called. It was about flying around the world. You had a little plane and you would fly around the world. You'd have to like connect various different goods. Actually, that wasn't my favourite one. I'm remembering it now. It was awful. God, that was boring. Why do we play that so often? I think Cluedo. I think, again, here's a boy who's perpetually murdering his action man in different ways, so take me to the conservatory and give me the spanner.
Thank you so much for joining us on So I Start a Revolution From My Bed, a podcast about nice things, mindfulness, favourites, you name it. We're going to have a nice conversation, and Robin Ince is the perfect guest for this. He is an author, he is a broadcaster, he is a comedian. His book, I'm a Joke and So Are You, is just brilliant. It really helped me at the time, and I really recommend it. But this is a kind of Christmas special, because on the Cosmic Shambles Network, which is what Robin is a part of, along with Josie Long, they're doing a live Christmas Day special. Could you think of anything better? So make sure you tune into that. Go to the Cosmic Shambles Network, which is cosmicshambles.com, and just get involved in that, because that's perfect for lockdown, isn't it? And yes, this podcast is all about mindfulness and all of that kind of thing. It comes from a chronic illness perspective, so there's going to be people that, once lockdown is over, hopefully, touch wood, there's a place in the future where it is, people with chronic illnesses, they're still going to be housebound and isolated. So let's have them borne in mind in this as well. And if you need any help whatsoever, this podcast is produced in support of The Calm Zone. So that's the campaign against living miserably. They've got a helpline, 0800 58 5858, calmzone.net. Go find them on the internet. They've got a web chat. And also, if you can spare any money, if you enjoy this episode, please give a donation to them. So let's talk to Robin Ince about his favourite things, his nice things, his mindfulness exercises. How does he cope? What's he found about himself in lockdown? Lots to talk about. Don't forget the Christmas special. Let's get straight into this. This is Robin Ince on So I Start a Revolution From My Bed. Right, so I'm joined by Robin Ince, who I can't thank enough, because I've met Robin a few times now, and you've always been so bloody nice, genuinely nice. We went for a drink in Canterbury after one of your gigs once, and then since then you've just been lovely and attainable, and I've always recommended your book because it is just incredible. Can you first of all tell me a little bit about what the book is about?
Well, the book was, do you know what, it's one of those weird things. I think whatever I eventually wrote was not the plan of the book that I originally, it's about trying to understand what it is to be human and how we become who we become and then how we deal with that, but looking at it through the lens of various kind of myths sometimes and sometimes truths about stand-up comics. Because I thought stand-up comics so often are, you know, you see those documentaries and they show the worst traits, or they show the most miserable traits, or they tell you they're the saddest stories, because it connects well. To say that someone who's made you laugh had some terrible secret, whatever it might be, is perfect for the documentary maker. So I thought, if I kind of pick those apart a little bit and use those as a springboard, it's a good way of looking at the fact that the experience of a stand-up comic is actually the experience of an enormous number of human beings. And so, you know, the creation myth of a stand-up comic, what happened to them as a child, you know, with Peter Sellers, he was too close to his mother, apparently, Peg. You know, for a lot of other people, it's about the loss of a parent or a divorce, things like that. So I would use each chapter would start off with those kind of ideas and then branch out and look at how for everyone, you know, and any child who has had some sense of trauma, and sometimes it might be something on the page does not even appear to be traumatic. But of course, when you're very little, things can be very traumatic, which may well appear minor to. I mean, my friend Rebecca, who I interviewed in the final chapter, which is about death, because my mum died not long before I started writing the book. And Rebecca lost her dad when she was six, and her sister was murdered when she was in her early 30s. And she made a play all about her sister, her reaction to her sister's murder. And it's a great piece of work called Sometimes I Laugh Like My Sister. And when she walked off from the first day of doing it, she looked at the director, a friend of hers called Martin. She went, "I now know who it was who was speaking up there." And Martin looked a bit confused, like, well, it's you, it's your story. And she went, "The person who was speaking was the six-year-old that no one listened to when her father died." And, you know, and hearing those stories, you know, it became more and more difficult to write, because I realised that there was, initially it was kind of quite, you know, it was going to be hopefully a fun book with some ideas of psychology and neuroscience in it. And then sometimes you talk to your friends, I'm sure you've had this, you're talking to your friends and you've known them for years, and one day their secret comes out. And I don't mean that as in a bad secret or something they've deliberately, it's just the thing that they never felt they could share. When you're in your various different social situations. And then suddenly you're talking through that and you realise, what I've really realised in particular since writing the book and going off and doing events, and I think I kind of knew it to an extent, but it's only since, is when I do gigs about it or when I do talks or whatever, the number of people who have a story that they want to share afterwards, and never in an intrusive manner, it's always, do you mind, or can I just, you know, and you realise that again, especially if you're a stranger, which can happen as a performer, you can become a stranger who is briefly trusted after a show, and you just find out how many things people carry with them. And so, yeah, the book was a huge education for me, in particular afterwards, you know, and travelling around with it.
And it's called I'm a Joke and So Are You, and that's the perfect title for it. And you're right, I did exactly that with you, in that because I read the book and I was like, this is everything to me. Then I kind of, because of the illness, I've always felt like I'm batting up to people. I've never owned the illness, and it gave me a little bit more confidence to go, okay, no, this is me, you know, whatever, I can kind of talk about and write about a bit more. But then I gave you some other kind of stuff that I wrote, because I've written anonymously, which I'm not going to admit to, but I kind of sent that your way and go, look, don't need to react to it, but thank you for writing the book, this is kind of the story and everything. And have you found that then, that people are a little bit more open with you because they've seen you on the stage, they read the book, they know you from radio and TV? So do you get more honesty out of people for those reasons?
I don't know, but I mean, I think, like my friend Josie and a few other people, that there's not a huge disparity apart from volume and speed in terms of the difference between us on stage and off. And because we both, you know, Josie and me play to quite small audiences, they're quite kind of niche art centre audiences. And I think very often there will be a few commonly held things that you have with the audience. Yeah, they come to you because there's certain things you've... So I think also by being... I'm always around after a gig, you know, very rarely, unless I have to get the last train, I have to dash. I'm normally around and I'm very happy to talk to people because, like I was saying at the beginning, there's so many people have a story that they want to tell, and it's so interesting. So, but I have found it's been very interesting. I've never had it in an intrusive way from anyone. I've always... Sometimes you are told stories and you just... You're knocked flat by what people have to go through, you know. And, you know, I was talking to my friend Rebecca again the other day, and I do think, you know, with her, and then we did a show the other day on the Shambles show that I've been doing during lockdown. We did a show about mental health and depression and also grieving, with a guy called James Withy, who's just written a book called How to Tell Depression to Piss Off, and also Rebecca. And both of them lost a parent when they were very young. And beforehand, I said to people, here's an email address. You can send an email. We won't say anyone's names if you've got questions. And someone who regularly comes to my gigs just sent me this thing of what's been going on in their life in the last few years. And I knew they'd had some, but it's that bit where you go, well, that's a lot to do. And I think the more that we're able to realise how much people are up against, and also to be reasonably open to... You know, it's that that moment that I think of my friend Helen Crimmins, who we did a benefit a few years ago for. Her partner Barry Crimmins was a great, really great American comic, real great activist comic, and Helen had cancer, and they live in America, so wow, its insurance is really difficult and stuff like that. And so we did a benefit, Billy Bragg and Charlotte Church and Grace Petrie and Alexi Sell and a load of us, and I said to Helen beforehand, do you want me to read out anything, or do you want to record a message or anything like that for the audience? And she just sent me a thing that she'd written out, and it was just about her experience at that point. This was the second time that she'd had cancer, and one of the things that stuck with me was she just said, sometimes when you ask how I am, you don't have to say anything more after that. And I think that's one of the hardest things for all of us, is when we do have friends, relatives, whatever it might be, and when they have problems and they have things they want to share, is I think it's a very human thing to want to have a solution. And that's one of the hardest things. You're desperate to say, oh, don't worry, I had a friend with that, actually, and they're fine now. Or I've heard, you know, nutmeg's very good for that. Or whatever it might be. You know, we've all got this. And it's a hard thing. But that bit of going, okay, I'm trying to learn it. As you can tell, I'm overly verbose. But that bit of going, okay, I'll stand back now. And I'll just say it, you know, and that's the thing. And I think that is such an important part of it as well. It's not always easy. And sometimes you fail. Sometimes we all fail as well.
I completely agree with that, because I've had that all the way through my life of, oh, you've got this, have you tried? And chances are it's something that's, you know, a little bit hokey, bless it, but it's I've always taken it in the context, people just want to help. They want they've heard you're going through something, how can I take that away from you? So you must feel some degree of a, not necessarily responsibility, but it must be interesting, the dynamic that you've got with people, that they are so open with you about various different things that have gone in their life. So is it only recently you've learned to kind of sort of step back and go, I understand, or have in the past, have you tried to create some sort of solution or something like that? What responsibility do you feel?
Oh, sure. Yeah, in the past, you know, we'll just turn it into a joke or whatever. I mean, it's so much of it comes that some people, you know, seem to arrive into adulthood almost fully formed. Some of us, it takes absolutely ages. I think, you know, an enormous change for me would have been, I mean, my stand-up changed hugely, and the art and the stuff I was making changed hugely around the same time as my son was born as well. And I think, you know, already I was changing things, and then suddenly you have that, and then suddenly you have that responsibility. And sometimes that also brings into focus your childhood and the things, you know, and so I think in the last 12, 13 years has been where I feel like that was the bit where I've certainly never become an adult, but it might have become where I've become more kind of fully formed. And it does worry me, because I mean, one of the first things that worries me and has always worried me is I'm tremendously worried about upsetting people. I can't stand that. And, you know, which perhaps as a comedian is not a good thing, but I don't like it. I really have to be able to justify if I've made someone upset or things like that. So that worries me as well, because sometimes if people do share something with you, you think, I can't give anything, or I can't. And then there's the other problem, which can happen sometimes, which is sometimes if someone sees you too much as if you're a friend, when in fact you're someone who stood on a stage and told some stories, and you sometimes have to say, I'm not the person to offer the solution. I'm not the person you should be speaking to. And that can be problematic.
Yeah, I completely agree with that, because of the position that I'm in, you do get quite often vulnerability that comes your way in one form or another. And you haven't got the solutions, you're not necessarily a professional, and you want to help as much as possible and signpost things, but it can be tricky to get that balance. And for someone like you, you can tell with you that you are very conscientious on stage. And I'm going to digress slightly for a moment, but you tell a poem in your stage about your son and building a den. And I think that's relevant to the things we're going to be talking about in a minute, of mindfulness and that just experiencing life and taking it on. Have you, obviously not at the moment because we're in lockdown, so the question is, firstly, how has lockdown treated you? What's been your experience of that?
I've been very fortunate so far. I've been fortunate in, though I've had friends who've lost people, in terms of my family, everyone's been well, and I am. It's one of those things, isn't it, which is lockdown, as everyone has realised, is really focuses you on what you've got. on noticing, you know, the fact is I don't have a very big garden. It's a, you know, it's just got a small garden, but it's big enough for my son to put on his boxing gloves and me to put on some pads and to do a bit of boxing and just space. It means I've got somewhere where I can sit and the sky is above me and there's not, you know, and all of those. So I've been doing all right. And I think also because with Josie and my friend Trent and various others, I've been making a show every single morning. So it's given some shape and form. And that's generally how I react to you know, strange things is what can I make, which might be descending into busyness, I don't know, but it is that thing which is, rather than spend too much time contemplating without doing anything, I just go, right, let's make some stuff, let's create some kind of connection with this, let's see what we can do with it. So I've been lucky, I think.
And that leads me into the next question, which was on my list, is you've been doing Stay at Home Festival, which has been incredible. Yeah, you've had so many guests that I can't even begin to say off the top of my head because it's just been so many. So who conceived that and how did it all come about? And can you just give an idea of what's going on with that?
Well, it was basically that, with my mate Trent, once we knew this was going to happen, we were like, we need to kind of, let's see if we can make something. Let's see, because I knew that in terms of all the gigs that I was doing that were cancelled and also Josie's gigs and various things that Trent and I were working on, that for a lot of the people who come to a lot of different gigs, you know, a lot of the music gigs that people go to, comedy gigs, theatre gigs, whatever, they can mean quite a lot to people. That really is an important part of the, in the same way as, you know, one of the sad things that happened right at the beginning of pretty much the lockdown or not far off was Tim Britt Taylor dying. And Tim Britt Taylor, I'd done an event with him at the end of January, and it was all three goodies, 50th anniversary celebration, and it was a great night. And the reason I mentioned that is the Slapstick Festival, which I do every January, that connection that people have when all of those people who sometimes, if they're with their friends, are seen as geeky and nerdy for the intensity of love they might have for Laurel and Hardy or Buster Keaton or the goodies or whatever it might be, everyone's in a room together. And I know how much that means to people, that you can turn to someone and suddenly talk about something which for most audiences would be quite an arcane thing to talk about. And so I started thinking, right, we need to let's work out a way that we can do these kind of connection things. And then we did a dummy run, which was like reasonably disastrous in terms of, the technology doesn't work. But Trent's brilliant. So very quickly went, I need to buy this and plug this in and plug this in. And so within 3 days, we were able to, and I'd already sent out emails. I mean, literally emails and texts to pretty much everyone that I knew, and people just leapt straight back. You're like, Mark Gatiss was the first person just to reply. I went, yep, of course, I'm not doing anything else. Very happy to. And lots of people were very generous with their time and just went, yeah, that sounds great. And it was lovely because some of the acts don't ever use that form of technology. So, you know, there was a beautiful moment. I think the third show we had Joe Brand on, and she can't get the technology working. And so Trent is explaining how it works because she never uses any of this stuff. So it's had to be downloaded. And it was like watching a movie where David Niven is a pilot in World War II and he's being talked down because, you know, the wheels aren't on his plane, and it was this beautiful thing. And then at 10 o'clock on the dot, everything connected, you know, Joe understood, oh yeah, there, I need to do that. And then we had a, you know, a lovely chat. So it's been very, and it's lovely also seeing what people have done with their hair during this particular time. You know, I've seen that a lot of men of my age who are still able to have gone Mohican, never had one. The lockdown's going to be for a while. It'll have grown out by then. No one will know. And then you kind of Skype them and you go, oh yeah, that looks really good. Oh yeah, just thought I'd do that. Yeah.
Well, how's your hair been? Have you been tempted to do the buzz cut?
Receding. But I did just say that tomorrow, if I said, I think we need to get some clippers. I think it's going to be necessary. Yep.
That's where I'm quite lucky, because mine, it tends to be all right lengthwise on whatever way. So I'm like, oh, sorry, I'm just going to leave it. And I'm almost tempted to kind of go for that full kind of mullet look if I can get it. Just nostalgia.
Well, also, you're all right, because when you've got hair, the trouble is, once you've lost your hair like I have and you've still got lumps of it, if you sleep in an odd way, what previously just looked eccentric now looks like some kind of elaborate comb over. So you also, I mean, it's what I always used to say to the barber in the last 10 years, I'd always say to whatever barber I go to, at no point try and cut this in a way that I'm trying to conceal that genetically the inheritance is now occurring and the recession has begun.
I like the fact that we can get the lockdown comb over. It almost is it's today's style. It's what we all need to be doing. So I'm going to ask you a few questions, because, I mean, I knew that when I spoke to you, I knew that I could just keep going and going and going. So I'm going to bring in some of the themes that I want to speak about as well, because I want to hear more about the Stay at Home Festival. But I'm currently speaking to you on Skype and I can see your room, and it is perfectly Robin in. So I was hoping it would be. How many books do you think you've got in that room?
Do you know what? I've got, all I can say is that last year, I think it was last year, I gave away about 1,000 books.
Wow.
And it made no difference whatsoever to the look of where I live, because it's a terraced house and it is just stacked up. And I can't, and the weird thing is, I think they breed, because I haven't really bought any apart from my mate Jeff Towns, who runs a fantastic, he's got a mobile bookshop and an old mobile library, and he has all of these weird things that he puts up for sale, and I just keep buying little strange pamphlets from the 1930s and stuff like that. But yeah, I've got no idea. There was like 1,000 books that went to Leicester Prison, and I looked and I went, no one would have a clue. No one then goes, doesn't the house look neat? They don't realise it just means that the tide of books goes just, it's a little bit further out than it used to be.
I like the fact that you said they're breeding, because I'm now thinking book gremlins. That's totally going to be a thing. But you gave them to Leicester Prison.
Yeah, I've got a mate at Leicester Prison, and who I don't know if that job is, you know, of course, for so many people. But and I went there a while ago and did a talk, which was really interesting as well, because I went in there and just in the little library, and when I saw the library, I thought, well, actually, I've got loads of books, so you know, that probably go to the library there. And it's such an interesting thing going to a place like that, where, like, just before I left, there was suddenly going to be a lockdown in the prison. It was only a minor thing. It wasn't like one of those major moments you see in a Hollywood movie where then I'm trapped as a hostage. Just something went slightly wrong, and there was this guy there, and he said, oh please, can I just read Robin my poem? And he just really wanted to read this poem, and it was such an interesting moment to see, you know, here's this guy who it wasn't a bad poem. You know, it's one of those ones where you wouldn't necessarily, it's W.H. Auden. It's not W.H. Auden, but it's also not a bad poem. It's a good poem, and it's a poem that came from the heart. And it was a really interesting thing to have that experience.
Well, that's brilliant. That fits totally in with the other work I do. I love the fact that you're giving them to a prison. Right, I'm going to quickly jump on the first question, because, again, I knew I could speak to you for hours. So if you used to have a moment of comfort, you're settling in. I know you don't do it because you're constantly on 100 miles an hour, but if you used to settle down for a night, how would you set up your comfort surroundings? Have you got lighting? Have you got nice little accompaniments that you do?
Do you know what? I do nothing like that. I really do just, I've got an old sofa and I sink into that sofa, and I've then got that stack of DVDs that you bought with good intentions, and I kind of shuffle through those, and then I start one film and decide, no, I don't fancy that. And then I start a second film, and then about the third film, then it kicks in. But I've got no, you know, it's nice to have, it reminds me almost like one of the comfort things, I think, is when my son was first born, and I would, for some period of the night when my wife needed to get sleep, I would kind of set up this table. And so I'd have him in one arm, and then on this table there was a bottle of red wine, and there'd be like snacks like Maltesers and stuff like that, and some peanuts. And I'd put in a documentary that would be some part of research for whatever my next stand-up show was. And I would sit there, so one arm with him and one arm that would have, you know, I didn't drink the whole bottle, by the way, I'd like to make that clear now, you know, but just, and I would just sit there having, in some ways it was one of the most creative times that I had. Because I had this 5 hours that, apart from the little moments when he'd wake up, he was so small then, I'd just be focused, just making notes. And it had a lovely comfort to it, actually, that.
That's reassuring, because, as you know, I'm expecting my first in September. And I just thought, you know, I'm going to write off the next few months of not being able to do a single thing. So the fact that you have been productive at that. And also, I'm honoured as well, because the reason we connected years ago is because you watched the film The Culture High, and then I saw you tweeting Rufus Hound, and that's how we kind of did our initial introduction. So the fact that you are so selective on your film, thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no, that's one of those great things. Social media, it's very easy to see the terrible things, and there are things in terms of, you know, dogmatism and in terms of refining people's bigotry. But my general experience from it has been exactly things like that. You end up, you know, Laura Kidd, who you saw last time at Canterbury when she was She Makes War, and now she's does a new incarnation, Pen Friend. And again, that happened. I saw this thing. It was called Stargazing. I listened to the song. I tweeted about the song. And then we started chatting. And the next thing is you go, oh, well, let's do a gig together, or let's, you know, and those things, I think, are the best sides of social media, is, you know, people who are using it to kind of sow insurrection and hatred and create division. You go, wow, man, you're missing a dopamine hit, and you're missing a much better trick, which is actually you can end up having really interesting conversations and building things with people.
Which is why you've always been so cool, because you've literally been so accessible and nice to people. You really are. So on that theme then, this might be a bit difficult for you, but have you got a comfort film that you'd like to put on? If you're going to kind of zone out, what would it be?
It's hard, that one, because I was thinking there's a lot, there's certain films that I go back to a lot, but I think the film that I would have is there's a film called The Fallen Idol. And it's odd, it's one of those films which I think a lot of people don't know about, even though many people have heard of The Third Man, which is the director Carol Reed's film, which has a small part with Orson Welles, but a very memorable part as Harry Lime. And that's based on a Graham Greene story. And there was another story Graham Greene wrote that was called The Basement Room. And this is turned into a film called The Fallen Idol around the same time, 1948. And I think it's a film that I watch at least once a year. It will be between that and A Matter of Life and Death. With beautiful film with Kim Hunter and David Niven. And both of them, I think, have various things in them. One is the fact they do have a connection with my dad. They're the kind of films we watch together. And the other is that both films have a tremendous beauty to them and Matter of Life and Death is about love. If people have never seen it, it starts off, David Niven is in a bomber plane. He's flying back to England, but it's on fire and he's not going to make it. And he's talking to the American person who's there at the airbase. What's your name? June. I love you, June. I love you, June, because you're life and I'm leaving it. Now that, I mean, just the beauty of that. But then The Fallen Idol is a very beautiful film because it's about a young boy who's been brought up in an embassy. So he's one of those ones slightly detached from his parents. His mother's been ill and he has a very strong relationship with the butler, played by Ralph Richardson. And it's a film about kind of betrayal and sadness and trust. And it's just the child in it, Bobby Henry, it's an amazing performance. Carol Reed was brilliant at directing actors, at child actors. He made Oliver, Jack Wilde and Mark Lester. But it's a very beautiful, it shows a post-war London, London Zoo, all these little streets, all of these little alleys. It's about friendship. It's about, bonds of trust. And it's just beautiful. And I love it for so many different reasons. I love watching films and going, I know that street. And that's not there anymore. And that's, the little town that I live in Hertfordshire, I saw Adam Curtis put up a film made in the 1970s about a gang of Hell's Angels coming to visit this town, right? And it's such a funny film. And it's like they end up kind of trying to kick in a narrow boat. And then they brought a little portable TV so they can watch Doctor Who. And then there's a bit where they go, they've decided to have a fight with the police. And then it goes, they've changed their mind about having a fight with the police. And it's just filled with it. And then there's one of the characters called something like Cross Eye. Cross Eye's called Cross Eye because he had both of his eyes punched out in a fight and they had to be placed back in. No, he didn't. But what I loved about watching that film is it's the town I live in. I was going, oh, look, that Indian takeaway used to be a little Italian. I love all those bits, those little bits of connection of time, of kind of the psychogeography of nostalgic films. So I love Fallen Idol for many. And Ralph Richardson in it, there is a scene of heartbreak in a cake shop, which is one of the finest scenes of heartbreak you will ever see.
Okay, that's a challenge. So I must admit, I've not actually seen it. I know the film, but I've not seen it yet.
So beautiful. And it's probably that I bug people most about that. And there's a film by Chris Pettit from 1979 called Radio On, which has a lot of craft work in it and stuff like that. And I've been recommending that a lot recently, of course, because Florian Schneider from Kraftwerk recently died. And I was saying, watch this film. It's a British road movie set on the West Way on a trip down to Bristol with an incredible soundtrack of Bowie and Kraftwerk and loads of other greats, and that's my other film that I bang on about too much.
Wow. And have you got a box set that in that same theme that you'd put on for just zoning out?
I see, that's a tough one, because the one that's next to my TV at the moment is Alan Bleasdale's GBH, which is,
oh yeah, I remember it, yeah.
Oh man, it's a masterpiece. But I think the one that I most go back to is Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. I think Alec Guinness as Smiley, I think just the whole world that sets up, the strange, devious world of these pampered, sexually ambiguous but damaged public school boys who are running the country. Secret. It's just such a, it's an intro, and it's so slow. I like things that are, the older I've got, the more I don't like things that make sense too immediately. So a lot of Hollywood movies, I go, yeah, I realise what's going to happen here. There's the twist because this is that stage of the movie or whatever. Mm. I like those films where at the end of it, you go, I'm not entirely sure what was going on there, but that was fun.
And I think that if you only know Alec Guinness for Obi-Wan Kenobi, you're missing out, because there's, obviously he's a well-known actor, but there's so much more to him than that, because he was just, it was so different for his time. He was far more subtle, I think, as you just said, a lot of times things are too signposted these days. But he knew how to play it so calm and so collected.
I love it. John le Carré talks about the fact that they spent a whole day trying to work out what kind of glasses George Smiley would have. And they spent the whole day looking at different glasses. And then eventually the glasses that Alec Guinness chose were exactly the same as the ones that John le Carré wore.
Oh, really? You know,
just perfect. Interesting little things going on all the time.
Are you a Lady Killers fan? Would you say?
Oh, love it. Yeah. I love those Ealing films. I think are masterpieces. That period of kind of mid-40s. Hue and Cry is another of my favourites, because you've got Alice. Because I love Alistair Sim. And, of course, in Lady Killers, Alec Guinness plays Alistair Sim.
Of course,
he's got the teeth there, and he's being Alistair Sim.
I didn't put that together. Oh, my word, I can't believe it.
Oh, it took me till I was in my late 30s. Don't worry, and you're not there yet, so I wouldn't worry about it. You haven't yet reached the time where you realise Alec Guinness is Alistair Sim. You're a young man.
Well, I don't know about that. I turned 40 last month, and my parents are 40. I'm not. I can't believe it. Jeez. So the reason that I've conceived those questions is because comfort is obviously quite important to people with chronic illness, because you have to set yourself up. Prime example, last night was a massive migraine, so I just started saying trash on the background that I knew that I could focus on but not focus on. So it's that kind of disassociation but association. So I think you've answered those perfectly, because you get it. I knew the fact that you was going to have something brilliantly kind of out there, and not even that out there. I was expecting something a little bit more obscure, I must admit. So the fact that you have got stuff that I vaguely recognise.
Yeah, do you know what? There's that moment where I go, do I say Tarkovsky's Stalker? Then I actually just thought, what is the film that I've most seen? Because I think whenever you do any of those kind of things where you're given a Q&A, there is a temptation to put what you would like to imagine people think you watch most. Then you go, because I mean, you know, not far in third place would probably be the original version of RoboCop.
Really?
Which I think is a great film. I think Paul Verhoeven, I think it's. I remember Ken Russell, when he was on the South Bank Show end of the year thing, and him saying to Melvin Bragg that his favourite film of the year was RoboCop, and Melvin Bragg kind of go, but surely Ken, and he went, no, it's my favourite film of the year. And if you watch it, it is just, there's so many ideas in it, so much satire in it, so much, all of those things. Omnicore has gone into areas that previously weren't considered to be profitable. Hospitals, prisons, law you go, yep, you know, and the spoof adverts in it. I think it's a really great, to some extent, a retelling of Frankenstein as well. So much going on in that movie.
And I agree with you as well, because I'm a fan of Starship Troopers, because I think that does the same. I think that predicted a lot of the modern day world. You know, those, do you want to know more? Click. And, that's just everything. We know that now. If we want to know more, we click the link. But back then, in the late 90s, that was... it still wasn't heard of. And the fact that it's, a satirical take on tribalism and battles and things like that. So I completely agree with you that he's underrated as a storyteller, but I just never would have had you down as RoboCop.
Oh, I loved it. You know what? I went to see it and I didn't think I'd like it. I was at 18 when it first came out, and I was with my friends Carolyn and Heather, and it was like, oh, well, let's go and see it. And then I went to see it again 3 weeks later. I saw it 3 times on the big screen, which is as many times I've seen Gandhi on the big screen, which is a good double bill, Gandhi and RoboCop. But you've got to try and watch a Gandhi second if you want to get the right kind of sense of peace. But it's, I just thought it was magnificent, and it was not at all what I imagined it was going to be. And I love those certain films where you sit down and maybe it's the first bar of music, it's the first shot, and you just go, I'm going to love this film.
And it
doesn't, there's a great film called The Unbelievable Truth by a director called Hal Hartley, and I remember again sitting watching that, and just the moment the first panel went up, the first bit of the I was like, yep, I'm gonna love this, and it became one of my favorite films.
So I associate RoboCop as well with The Running Man, which I love the film. I don't necessarily admit it, because I don't think it's got the foresight that RoboCop had in some ways, but I totally associate the two together. So I'm now going to take you to looking forward. So we've been in lockdown. I'd imagine most of us are going stir crazy to one degree or another. So if there's a live event that you would look forward to, it could be anything you want, what would that live event be?
Well, it was the one that I was looking forward to, and I think it will happen again next year. I think it probably would be going to see Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, which was what I was going to go. And in fact, I think it would have been on the day we're recording this, it would have been, yeah, Saturday, this two days later, in two days' time, I'd have been going to see Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. I just find that, you know, going to see an artist like that, and it's amazing how enormous he's become now. He's an arena filler, you know, and an icon and a mainstream figure. But when you go and see him, there is no one, I can't think of any other performer of all the performers that I love watching who that level of connection occurs. Even the last time I saw, no, actually not the last time I saw him, time before last I saw him was at Nottingham Arena. I went up to Nottingham just to see him, and it just, he connected across, you know, 6,000 people. And people were, you know, I've often said this, but you would watch someone was pogoing and then they were weeping and then they were pogoing again. And then, and they were the kind of, I remember my wife turning to me and saying, wow, everyone's really nice here, aren't they? And I went, yeah, they're readers. You know what? I mean, that's what I like. A Nick Cave audience seems to be the kind of people, they like a library that stays open late, and they also like having a drink as well. You know, like me, they're one of their favourite places. Beer Wolf Books, which is down in Falmouth in Cornwall, which is, it's a bookshop and it's a pub. And it's the most dangerous of things because you buy some books, you buy a pint, and then you buy a second pint, and then those books that you weren't going to buy, you've lost all of your ability to say no to them. So, yeah, it's a great place.
And I agree. I think that I think Nick Cave has definitely had not a rebirth because, you know, he's been doing what he's doing, but people like my generation, we've known him for Red Right Hand, but then all of a sudden, you know, there's all these other things that suddenly open up, and the fact that he's been so eloquent about what happened with his son and things like that has just really garnered so much respect for him as a performer and a character. So hopefully you think you will still get back there, that performance.
Well, I think as far as I know, the tickets are for whenever it's going to be, whenever it's going to be rescheduled. But it was, and also I was just fascinated to see how he was going to do Ghosteen, because Ghost, you know, I've got to admit, Skeleton Tree, I was kind of thrown by the fact that was his first arena tour, because that is a song, you know, an album that is very delicate. Album and of course, whether, even though it was half finished by, you know, there was halfway through, I think, when his son Arthur died, so I think people do project onto it things that happened that might not. But of course, Ghosteen, well, that is an album that came after that, and it is an album which is dealing with, you know, a lot of great art, a lot of Nick Cave feels like a Rorschach test. You know, you look at it and people will see different things in it. But yeah, it was just, I was really fascinated to see, because Ghosteen was the longest time it took me to get into a Nick Cave album. It took me, you know, quite a few listens before I was going on. And then I was in the right level of darkness, in actual physical darkness, properly done, properly focused on the music. And I went, yeah, now the spell works. Mm. It's not a spell that, you know, some people it captured immediately. Me, eventually, I went, yeah, now I'm enveloped in it.
So you mentioned that you are a massive fan of bookshops, to say the least. You just mentioned that one that is just, it sounds fascinating, a pub and a bookshop. As you said, how dangerous is that? So have you got a bucket list destination, somewhere that you've not been yet? And it could be Universal. And I know you do a lot of things with Cosmic Shambles, and obviously being a friend of Brian Cox, you're constantly trying to understand how the universe is working. So where would that bucket list destination be?
I would like to go to, as near as you could, the event horizon of a black hole. You know, why not? It just feels, and you know what, if it does go wrong, what a way to go.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, if I go, no, keep the brakes on. Brian, what are you doing? Oh, you know, and as we're spaghettified. But I just think there are those certain things in the universe which are so enigmatic and strange to our kind of earthly minds. And the idea of being able to get in any way close to being able to view a black hole. So I'm going to stick that in as my my destiny, my death, and my bucket list. And also, if you're going to have a bucket list destination, why not make it that final destination?
That's perfect. And also, you've put on, because you've been very good to me, because you put your answers down to me on paper, but you also said, or potentially a moon of Jupiter.
Yeah, no, I'm quite keen on that as well.
Let's just take a pause for a moment. Don't forget, this is a time for reflection and nice things and just a bit of calm and a bit of breathing. Don't forget to breathe and go to the calm zone if you need help. Campaign Against Living Miserably. They're there to give you any help that you need. If you need the helpline, 0800 58 58 58. The web chat is available. And please, if you can, if you're enjoying this episode, give them a little bit of money. Donate to them if you can. Thank you very much. Just go chat to Robin Ince again. there must be a place in your mind that if you was to go for a little bit of a stroll, a little bit of a kind of a mindfulness exercise, where would that be? Where would you take yourself?
Well, do you know what? There was, I remember when we first talked about this, I gave you a different answer. But actually last night, I started to try and remember every room that I stayed in and every walk that I had on the tour that I did with Brian Cox last year. So last year, it was a really long tour. I mean, it wasn't like in a horrible way. It was just fun. It was like we did nearly 100. In fact, last year, including radio shows and other events, I think we did like 115 gigs together. But we traveled the world. And it might be just because of them. I think some people I've spoken to have found that their dreams are going further than they used to go. And I think that might be because when you have restricted space to actually physically walk in, sometimes you dream. And I just found myself, as I was not quite hypnagogic, going, I wonder if I can remember the first room when we arrived in, where was it, Wilmington. And so I started off in Wilmington. And then I thought, right, then we go off to, where was it after that? Then we were in Philadelphia. Oh, yeah, I remember that room. There was a problem with the first room, so I had to move rooms. And then I went to that art gallery. So I walked up to the Philadelphia, has an amazing art gallery with a huge Marcel Duchamp collection, amongst many other things. So I kind of wandered around there. And then I wandered onto the hill where we did boxing practice. So on that one, I think I'm going to get into the habit of walking through last year's tour, because it also is... I started from where we were exactly last year, and I thought, and I'm always interested, sometimes I walk through, I mean, it's strange, when I first had insomnia, which I unfortunately don't suffer from very badly at all now, but partly, I suppose, because the deadlines have gone, but it has definitely decreased a great deal. I would return to some of the old schools that I went to, which, of course, I never enjoyed going to school. But I would just walk down those corridors, which, of course, had no fear because no one was in them anymore. I was the only one walking through these ghost corridors. And that interesting bit when you see in your memory how clearly sometimes you can remember colour and then other times you think, I can't remember what that floor looked like at all. I can't remember. And normally I'm good at remembering floors because I spent most of my childhood looking down at the floor. So, that's the one bit that I remember better than anything else.
That really fascinated me when you did say about school buildings. Is that, I mean, I wasn't at school very much because of the health, so, they were a bit of a kind of an enigma to me. But I can still remember the smells, like those dinner hall smells, even a drinking fountain smells. So do you bring back that as well? When you're thinking about all the kind of different places you've been, can you remember smell?
Do you know what? That's weird. I don't normally do that. And that though smell is, I mean, I think it's true for everyone. It is the quickest Proustian rush is when that moment where you walk past something and it just goes in very briefly and it almost makes the right neurons fire up, but it doesn't quite reach the accessible brain. So there's a memory in there, but you can't quite get it. And that smell's kicked off. But the moment you said that, I just thought of what I see as the smell of hairy mash. Which is that kind of, the mash that had kind of just those little hairs that popped out. And that seems to me to be a very distinct smell. I think that and chocolate custard are probably the two that I can most quickly, what a relief when it was chocolate custard day.
Can you remember a smell of a water fountain though? Because I think it was just different to any other water ever. It was almost like this chemical smell, but not quite. I don't know. It's hard to put into words.
Yeah, it feels, I think the best way if you want to get that back today is the best thing is just slightly dampen a pan and place your head in that. I reckon that might work. I can't be certain of that, but don't put it in too far or you end up as an outtake from Carry On Again, Doctor, I think.
I love that. Yeah. If I'm going to do any kind of promotional clips for this, put your head in a pan. That's going to be it.
Yeah, make sure it's not on the hob. I also like to make that clear. There's so many mixed messages there. Make sure you've taken the pan, take the pan into, a cool area and see if you can replicate the smell of drinking fountains.
Right, on that note, well, it's a perfect segue, actually, because, this is quite nostalgic. And I found that quite fascinating, what you just said there of recounting experience, because, I do that quite a lot because, people with chronic illness don't necessarily have huge amounts of experience, but the ones we have, we can really kind of grip onto and sort of savour. So nostalgia is hugely important to me. And I'm always doing this. I'm getting caught in YouTube black holes of Googling old adverts. Just today, I was watching Fred Dibner. Fred Dibner, just all the way through from his early stuff to his modern stuff. And I was just in my element. And my other half's like, what the hell are you watching? So on that note, and I've already pointed out to you the big yellow teapot behind me, what would be your favourite childhood toy?
I think it was, I had this one Action Man, which it was a blonde Action Man with beard. And it was just no other action. You know, sometimes I would get another one and I was never interested. What I used to do, I was very much a torturer of and smasher of things. I was always intrigued by what would happen if you melted the head of a doll. All of those, your toy cars. In a Freudian way, we could make the link, as of course in the book I talk about being in a car crash when I was very small that I thought was my fault. I don't know whether that links or not, but I was fascinated in that sense of damage. So there's a scene in, have you ever seen Female Trouble, the John Waters movie?
Always really worried when you come up with references. I'm like, I want to know this. I want to know this.
No, do you know what? It's exactly what Josie said. Josie said to me this morning, she said, do you ever feel lonely that no one seems to know any of your references? And that was after I mentioned, you know, the mainstream film The Whisperer starring Dame Edith Evans. What, that's a no as well? Anyway, so I... no one would remember that. But it was... it's an interesting film, but no one does. But Female Trouble has this moment. It's another film starring Divine. And Divine's daughter, who has been brought up very badly, played brilliantly by Mink Stoll. How I love the names that the John Waters actors had. Mink Stoll plays Car Crash, the game that we often used to play with toy cars, but with the whole of a windshield of a car. And sits behind the remnants of a windshield, covering herself in ketchup. And so, and I remember seeing that when I was about 18 years old at the Scala Cinema and going... That's the scale of that I really wanted to play at. So I was always, but the action man that I had this little, and I tried to shave him as well. I remember getting a Bic razor that my mum must have had, a little, and I thought, I wonder if you can shave his beard off. And of course, all you do is expose glue. That's all you do. You then just end up with a glue-faced action man. And I never burnt that action man. I never did anything like that to that action man. But the other action man I got went through many tortures. Some fingers were removed. Frankly, there's a reason that my sisters used to say, you're going to grow up and be a serial killer. They used to say, I don't know what's wrong with you, Rob, because I used to be so fascinated, things like that. You know, lonely child who disfigures his toys. What is his destiny?
I'm pretty sure the film Toy Story has covered you in that, because there are scenes of like just mutilation. You just described that perfectly.
Love that. It's in Toy Story 1, isn't it? Those amazing macabre toys that the boy next door has made. Yeah.
So were you that kid then?
Yeah.
have you found your son's toys? Have you managed to play with them at all? Because I found with modern day toys, they're not the same. Like, they don't live up to my generation.
I think there's an interesting thing, which is everything has become... I mean, I'm old enough that I was before that level of mass marketing where every single show has its spin-off dolls. So you know, I was too old for He-Man toys and that kind of stuff and all of those things that existed. So I think there is a difference. I remember talking about this with Alan Moore, actually, where, you know, he had a limited number of toys that you would then redecorate to make whatever your latest favourite fad was.
Right.
And I think that was very much what I kind of felt as well. Whereas now you go, you're a big fan of Doctor Who, here's a Doctor Who toy. You like Toy Story, here's a Toy Story toy. So I think there is a difference in that. So we've, you know, generally done a lot of reading together, but not as much kind of play. And also I like the games. I love playing games like Uno and Exploding Kittens. I love the inventiveness of these very simple card games that have gone on. So I think that's, in terms of our experience of play, it's predominantly in that kind of area.
That leads perfectly to this question then. So have you got a favourite game, board game, card game?
I do love playing Uno with him. I think Uno is and quite often we play, all three of us play together. So I think Uno's quite high. I think as a kid, it probably was... Oh, let me think. I'm trying to think. The ones we had, a very strange game that was called something like, oh God, I can't remember what it was called. It was about flying around the world. You had a little plane and you would fly around the world. You'd have to like connect various different goods. Actually, that wasn't my favourite one. I'm remembering it now. It was awful. God, that was boring. Why do we play that so often? I think Cluedo. I think, again, here's a boy who's perpetually murdering his action man in different ways, so take me to the conservatory and give me the spanner.
I think that you would, and this is going to be possibly the weirdest compliment you've ever had, but I think you would be a good mass murderer, because I think A, you'd do it with style, and B, I think you'd be really good at hiding it.
Well, you see, the trouble is also, because I'm such a big fan of those Vincent Price films, the early 70s, the Fibes films and Theatre of Blood, where if you've never seen the first Dr. Fibes films, he kills people in the different biblical plagues, locusts, etc., and frogs. And then Theatre of Blood, he kills people in the style of different Shakespeare plays. And there's a beautiful lot like Robert Morley, who plays a theatre critic called Meredith Merridew, and he's given a Titus Andronicus murder. He has these poodles that he loves, and in the play Titus Andronicus, the children are killed and baked in a pie. In this, Vincent Price bakes Meredith Merridew's poodles in a pie. It's a fantastic film. It's a really great camp British movie.
You might be one of the only people that remembers this, but can you remember a film called Bluebeard?
Oh, yeah. The very rarely shown. It's never. I love that. There's certain films that just get entirely lost.
It was one of those ones that I used to watch it as a kid. I don't know why, but I did. But it was. It's basically that. It's I think it's an aristocrat that just loves a bit of murder, and yeah. It was fascinating as a child to see all these different ways he did it, and it was torturous. But as you said, almost that late night TV culture doesn't exist now, which is a shame because you did get to see some brilliant stuff, I think.
See, I wonder sometimes in terms of imagination. I think it's brilliant that people have such easy access to so much. But I also think the fact you were forced into cul-de-sacs of entertainment, the fact there was no choice, and I'm not saying it was a golden age, because anyone who says there was a golden age of television, if you actually look at an old TV or radio times, you will go, oh my God, Summertime Seaside Special with Mike and Bernie Winters. It was not, you know, it wasn't a better time for entertainment, but I do think that bit of going, this is all we've got, so let's see what happens with this film. And then because I think if you're always being given an algorithm that directs you to what the algorithm believes you'll like, you're going to miss a lot of treasures that you had. That's why I think it's always important to, if you can, try and go and see a band that you don't really know very much about. Go to an art exhibition that you think, I don't really know anything about this. See things that you're not sure you'll like, because that's where very often you get those great Damascene moments of like, wow, turns out that is brilliant.
I completely agree as well that the late night TV culture, there was stuff like the other day I was watching In Bed With My Dinner with Bob Mills. And again, I love Bob Mills, and it's just one of those things of, I would never have watched that if there was streaming channels, because you had no choice back then. And as where Davina McCall launched in God's Gift, which was just which again, if you look back at that, would not get away with it in this day and age, but of its time, it was brilliant.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
So what would be your favourite childhood TV programme? It doesn't have to be late night. It could be any kind of schedule you like.
Oh, it probably would be Sapphire and Steel. I'm trying to think now of my favourite ones. And I do think, I really love the spooky ones. I love the strange. It's going to be, you know, Doctor Who is high in there, obviously. Particularly, I was lucky. I was the right age to hit it when Doctor Who went through its Hammer horror phase with Philip Hinchcliffe as the producer. So you had Tom Baker, who I think is such an interesting and eccentric actor. You had these fantastic, you know, Pyramids of Mars, which was basically a Mummies movie. Brain of Morbius, which is basically Frankenstein. They were all these kind of gothic horrors. And I have, you know, a tremendous love of that. But it would be within that, in that area, I think.
Who would be the favourite Doctor? Would it be?
It
Tom
was
Baker?
Tom Baker, because yeah. I mean, I don't know how much it is down to, obviously everyone would say your first one, the one that you grew up with. But I also love reading interviews with Tom Baker. I love listening to Tom Baker. I think he is, he's you know, and he used to hang around in Soho with Francis Bacon and, you know, all of these different kind of the Soho set. And there's a lovely, I was chatting to an old friend of his who said, you know, quite often Tom would have just done an advert and he would come straight into the French House, which I don't know if you ever knew the French House. I don't know if it's still, I don't think it's, it was a small bar and you could only get pints in you could only get a half pint. You couldn't get a pint. And he would go in and there would be, you know, Francis Bacon and that, and he would just say, come on then, let's go and hammer the optics. And so once he'd got the cash from doing whatever, an advert for Flymo or something, they would hammer the optics. And I think, yeah, he's a very interesting character. That's not to in any way diss those other people who all have interesting backstories to them as well. But I think Tom Baker himself and I love that story of the man who came up to, I'm sure you know, Oxford Street one day, he was walking down the street and this man came up to him and just stopped him and he said, oh, can I just tell you, he said, I was brought up in a children's home, and every Saturday night when you were on, it just made things, it was just that there was a glimmer there, and apparently the guy just put his thumbs up and just walked away, and that's all he didn't want to say any more. Yeah. And it's what I was talking about when you know, just after Timbert Taylor died, and you know, talking to some of the Goodies fans and stuff, is the Goodies again was a show where it was a mainstream show and lots of people loved it. But you know, there's that bit, isn't there? Lots of people love a show, but then there's the point where you really love the show and you're quite obsessed with the show. And that is where, I, you know, for a lot of people, that moment when the Goodies was on, there was another bit where you weren't enjoying school, you weren't having necessarily a good time growing up, but it's the Goodies tonight. And everything else is forgotten for that half hour. And yep. I think those are very important, those shows.
That's a perfect summary of why those questions are formulated. Because, again, with chronic illness, quite often that point of escapism is so necessary. You know, it's holistic. So for me, I put Mighty Boosh, I put Detectorists. Because, I mean, Detectorists, just the theme tune alone is just like, oh, I'm on opiates. It's just perfect.
Detectorists is a perfect creation, isn't it? There's nothing. There is not a fault in that, in every moment of casting, delivery, in the look of it. I mean, I just think Mackenzie, it's such a great thing, isn't it? You know, I wonder what Mackenzie did after The Office. I know he was in Pirates of the Caribbean, blah, blah, blah. He waits and he waits and he's like, I know, I think he's written a couple of children's books as well, hasn't he, Mackenzie? And he's always seemed to me like, I remember years ago, first gig I did with him was when he used to do a character called Charlie Cheese with the Wheel of Cheese.
I remember that.
And then I met him immediately after, didn't recognise him. He'd introduced me on stage, but without the wig and the glasses and everything, it was like, oh, yeah, I'm the bloke who did the character. Oh, hello, Mackenzie. And then, Detectorist, perfect.
I think he's comes from somewhere around my way as well. I think he's Gravesend or somewhere like that, I think. Yeah. Sorry? Oh, Dartford, apparently. Being corrected over my shoulder. I have to get you on the microphone at some
point. There's not enough footnotes. This is what I feel that this podcast is lacking footnotes, actually.
Totally. Right, so I'm going to get on to appreciation, and I'm, again, conscious of your time. So, again, appreciation, when you're in the surroundings that you're in all the time, that most people are experiencing lockdown, senses are quite important. So for me, I fully put my hands up that I do use candles. None of the floral stuff, you know, none of that. So if you was to be a candle maker, what would go into your special smelly candle?
Well, I think it would be Butterscotch Angel Delight, which I don't even know if that's still produced. I'm not sure.
I'm pretty sure it does.
But that moment when your mum was putting it in the mixing bowl and some of the powder, just that the candied powder would kind of, you know, hit your nostrils. And it was, there's something about whatever it's made of, which brings back, you know, again, it's another Proustian rush of just all of those different sensations, just the excitement of that.
I completely agree with that, because I've got a similar one of, I hate mint chocolate, but the only one I had in Angel Delight was mint chocolate Angel Delight. And I think it was the Sainsbury's own version. I don't think Angel Delight did their own. So I can completely understand that as well. Did you actually like eating it, or is it just the smell?
Oh, well, I think a lot of sweet things, it's the potential beforehand. It's the expectation. Yeah. It's like when you go past one of those beautiful cake shops, you know, and the window has just the way that the cream's been piped, the different bits of the way the chocolate flaking's been done. Yeah. And you can't stop yourself, but you know the best thing would be to not eat it because it's, you know, like so much of life, you know, the desire for that pastry will never, you know, again, like a lot of existence, the best bits are daydreaming about the potential of something rather than the existence of it. And there's nothing wrong with that. Make sure you enjoy those daydreams.
I've always, every podcast I've done, I've always tried to angle for sponsorship of Ben's cookies. It's never worked yet. I mean, this is produced in support of Calm Zone. But sponsorship, if you're out there, Ben's Cookies, please, because legendary. Did you try that? Because when I saw you at Canterbury last, I gave you a pack of Polish wafer tubes. Did you try those?
Yeah.
What did you think of those?
I love things like that because they're attached to, again, that consistency is attached to a history of childhood.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. When I found those, I was like, they're like crack. They are so addictive. They just slide down. Right, and you've, the answer to this one you've mentioned a few times, but and I can imagine I'm speaking to you now in a chapel of books. So is there a book that's helped you?
Yeah, it's always weird that, isn't it? Because all books have to some extent. I really think the world they can take you to, and the one that I was thinking when we first talked about this was. I did, and it's a recent one. So, I mean, this answer could be 2,000 different answers, and I think they would all be as true as each other. But I did find, you know, books that stay with you. I mean, one of the books that really stays, John Higgs, who wrote Stranger Than We Can Imagine, which is a history of the 20th century and how everything changes when you lose the final centre of being of humanity. Once quantum mechanics comes in, so we've lost all the other centres. We're not the centre of the solar system. We're not a special creature. We're part of all the other animals, and then we have, you know, quantum indeterminacy as well. That would be high up there. His book about the KLF burning £1 million is also an incredible exploration. But I think Alan Moore's Jerusalem is one that I just enjoyed. The first time I had to read it quite quickly because I was doing an event with him. And then I started again. When you first asked me that question, I just started reading it again. And I just thought it helps me because I love the layering of time that it deals with. And I think that can be a real comfort to people as well. I think there's, you know, Nietzsche talked about eternal recurrence, that the idea is to think that not this is the last day of your life, but that this is a day you're going to live for eternity. And the block universe idea, to some extent in physics, gives you that idea that all of time exists as a solid. And don't worry, it's not like you feel it and you don't get deja vu. You don't, but that idea of thinking each day is lived forever, sometimes I think that can be a helpful drive. So I think, you know, Jerusalem, where Alan basically, that much like James Joyce's Ulysses, I think it's probably slightly longer than that, though. His intention was almost to create something you could rebuild Northampton from. So in the same way James Joyce would say, you know, you could rebuild Dublin from Ulysses. And when you first go back to Northampton, and you've read the book, it's just packed with ghosts. And I love that. It's packed with every, you know, there's the Black Lion pub and I can feel one of those ghosts walking through me now. And as someone who doesn't have, I don't have any great kind of mystic beliefs, but I do love the comfort of ideas. And I think, you know, Alan covers so many different things and he creates voices that seem to me to be so authentic about so many, you know, so many different characters. He's able to walk in their shoes. And so I think that is another book, which I must just add. Sorry, I know it's only meant to be one, but let's just cheat. Which is, I would really recommend a book called Others. I don't know if I've said that to you before. Charles Fernerhoff, who is edited it. And it's just, it's all about, the drive behind it was, stories are a brilliant way of us going into other people's skin. And so it's people with lots of different experiences. Sometimes it's their own experiences, which involve, it might be about race, mental health, gender, sexuality, illness, whatever. And they're just short pieces, sometimes poems, sometimes fictional stories, sometimes little bits of memoir. And I thought it was a tremendously powerful book, especially, I think I was reading it when there was another debate about some bad taste comic. Oh. And I looked at their joke and I thought, do you know what? If they'd read this piece by this person who suffers from what you've just been mocking, you would realise what they have to go through in their life. And you would realise how difficult, because I think I've become more and more interested in the last few years about thinking about my own advantages and thinking about the things that I am that mean that when I leave the house, I don't immediately carry with me something which increases the chances of, you know, abuse or people behaving abominably or ignoring me or whatever. Because I am, you know, middle-class white male and I don't have a heterosexual, so I don't have a lot of things that other people, when they leave the house, they're immediately on their guard. And I think that book was really, really useful for just underlining that point and for exploring different people's sense of sometimes the battles they have to go through. Because I think we're at a period now where there's a great nonchalance where some people will say, people in my position, everything's sorted now. I mean, I don't know what, no one's got an issue with anyone being what they're not. And of course, we know that's bullshit because you go on social media and the moment someone is something other, the fury. You know, I've know it well from my friends who, you know, I keep mentioning Josie, but, you know, Josie is a great example of someone who, when I look at the amount of abuse that she's had on social media for a very long time, since she was pretty young, that was a real, you know, part of the realization of, even at that moment of going on social media, you and I have an advantage because we're male, you know. And so others, I just thought I'd really recommend it. It was just an unbound book and, it's filled with stories that I think are, you know, useful.
That's why, I unapologetically love you, because that degree of reflection is just perfect. If we all had that, yeah, the world would be a better place.
Oh, man, you're making it very hard for me, because you know how I'm a typical, you know, it's the trait, isn't it, that many of us carry with us, which is we spend all of our time seeking out those who loathe us, and any form of compliment makes us shrink into our own skin.
Yeah, exactly. I'm exactly the same. I can't punch me more than compliment me. I'll deal with it better. Yeah. So quickly moving on before I make you blush too much. Have you got a documentary that's meant something to you or changed your perspective or some way?
Oh, man, that's tough, because there are so many. I love documentaries. And, do you know, I'm not going to remember the name. It was made by Carol Morley. And, did I give you, I bet I gave you an answer when you originally asked. Yeah. Yeah, and I wonder what it was. I said it was Cosmos, didn't I, by Carl Sagan. And that would have changed things. And it did. That was a really important documentary. Nearly all of the documentaries also that have been done by Christopher Sykes, who made the documentary where it's just Richard Feynman sitting in a chair talking. But the one I was suddenly thinking of, that book, the documentary, dramatised documentary, with then the real people talking heads in it as well. Carol Morley, where it's about a young woman whose body was found in a flat in Wood Green, and she'd been there for a long time, and it was about how she'd ended up as this young person who'd been, had loads of potential and all this kind of thing, and yet she was then just someone who died in a flat and no one even knew she was dead. And it's made by Carol Morley. Look it up when you get a chance.
Yeah.
But that one was a really important documentary as well. But I love documentaries. I mean, there's a beautiful series called Seven Wonders, which were different scientists talking about their loves. And there's one with Miriam Rothschild, who, amongst other things, was an expert on fleas, did a lot of study in fleas. Oh, wow. And as you watch her with her rabbits that she keeps to comb the fleas off them and then examine the fleas, and she loves the fleas, she has to put a little bit of chloroform on them so they're not too jumpy. So the idea of, here is this wonderful old woman who is very carefully, so she's not killing the fleas, just making them a little bit sleepy. And I love having to work at that kind of level as well. So
a sleepy flea, there's a concept. It almost sounds like some kind of bizarre online tag, I think. I knew you'd come up with some brilliant answers for that. I'm very conscious of your time. So a song that gets you pumped and a song that gets you relaxed.
I'm sure I'll have put Jubilee Street when you ask me. But probably the one that I think most, the one that I've returned to most, and I used to have it as the penultimate song before I went on stage, because I always listen before I go on for half an hour. I basically always make the equivalent of a mixtape, because theatres have such great sound systems, so it's really nice to hear your favourite music through a really good sound system. And quite often I would come on to Waiting for the Great Leap Forward by Billy Bragg, but before that, Polyphonic Spree. I just delight in Polyphonic spree. I love what, I mean, they did a brilliant version of Neil Young's Heart of Gold, which is just magnificent. There's so many people involved in it. It's everyone banging an instrument, making a sound. But their cover version of Nirvana's Lithium is just, you feel as if it's a biblical scene where the walls of Jericho are coming down. It's just magnificent. I would also answer, by the way, the one in terms of coming down, I do think that last album by Leonard Cohen, You Want It Darker, with that song, You Want It Dark, is such a beautiful song as well. So I think Lithium to, that probably sounds wrong, doesn't it? Lithium to Take Me Up. It's but the Polyphonic Spree cover of Nirvana's Lithium, and then Leonard Cohen's You Want It Darker.
And then you've got down here that a song that relaxes you, I think, is Nick Cave's Ghosting.
Yeah, Nick Cave's Ghosting, yeah. Certainly. I don't know if it relaxes you. I mean, it takes you, I think, again, like certain bits of art, certain pictures, certain films, certain, it does almost, to me, that's the nearest to taking hallucinogens. You know, it's that bit where, and Ghosting, if you find the right place to listen to it and you just get quiet and you just put it on, that bit where he's lost. Again, that bit when I was talking about films, that I like films more and more which aren't clear. In the same way, Ghosting isn't verse, chorus, middle, eight. And so it kind of moves in a different way across you.
And then the last one that's before the quickfire, John, I've just given it away, but I asked you for an unsung hero, and it is John.
John Hegley, yeah. John Hegley. I just love John Hegley. I think John Hegley is, there's lots of people that I think should be, you know, I would also include another unsung hero is Joanna Neary, who is just a brilliant performer and writer, and did a wonderful character called Celia, which she still does. And I would like everyone to see her work. She's one, you know, there's certain people. Sometimes when I feel sorry for myself and I think, oh, do you know what? All of those ideas that I had that came to nothing or were stolen by people and turned into something else and they made money from it. Then I think of the people who really deserve to have had more. And Joanna Neary is utterly brilliant. And please, anyone listening to this, go and look up her work. And when lockdown ends, she runs a wonderful club in the Lamb Inn in Eastbourne as well. And then John Hegley, just because the first time I saw John, he just has something that's not like any other stand-up. And he's, you know, he's a poet and he has a real kind of, you know, beauty to what he does. And I think there's a bit of a whoop there. That's because, but I'll come back to that. But yeah, it's John Hegley, and I love it. I sometimes when I'm working with John, I will introduce him by singing Eddie Don't Like Furniture, which is such a great song. so I think what he is, he should be celebrated because he a deep place, a deep humanity in him, and an interesting, you know, human being, which is what Joe has as well. Joe has, I mean, I think in some ways, sometimes that's why some of the people become unsung or don't get the level of celebration that they deserve, is because they do plow so much their own furrow and they don't have a choice of saying, do you know what? I'm going to change that angle because I think that's where the money is now, or that's what the commissioners are into. They are what they are. And that's what they must be. And I mean, there's a beautiful thing on the Teachers channel. It's on YouTube now. They had various different kind of people going in to be a teacher in a primary school for a day. And John is one of the people who goes in to do that. Oh, wow. And watch John teaching the kids various things. Again, it just you see someone who has such a deep interest in human beings.
I completely agree with you that quite often they are unsung heroes for a reason, because they're just not known, because they're plowing themselves into the cause, into the work. I see that all the time in what I do in drug policy. There are so many people out there, like, you need to be on a pedestal, and, you know, no one necessarily understands or hear your voice, but, you know, just absolutely amazing what they do.
There was something that I read which kind of slightly, I can't remember whose book it was in, but there was a quote from someone which said, the more imagination required, the smaller the audience you'll have.
Nice. And yeah, I think
that is equally, of course, why you then get certain performers who people are incredibly You know, they just love their work and they will not leave them. And, you know, when Reeves and Mortimer started, you know, it wasn't like the biggest audience on TV, but pretty much everyone who was watching it absolutely adored it and would go and see everything that they did. So I think, you know, on the other side of it, but then there are some people who just never make it through. And I think it's a great pity because, and also we have a lack of imagination very often in those who are making things, because they're very often thinking, right, what we need to commission now, what's going to get the audiences?
Yeah, and in a way you could argue that's what's happened with podcast world. It's become this weird saturated field that's now been dominated by the kind of the big corporate places, and podcasts almost become a bit of a weird dirty word. Have you got time for the quickfire? We'll join there. You sure?
Yeah, of course. I'll just text him and say stop ringing. I told him I'd be late. They should know. We've only got to have a little chat about what we're doing on if we were still actually doing it from the Albert Hall, I might say I've got to go, but we're not. We're doing it all from our own rooms.
I mean, what's that like playing the Albert Hall? That's surely bucket list.
Do you know what? It's not. It's a really weird thing. One of the things that I've found out is that I've not had as big a kick, or, you know, I've not had the same sensation doing that I have from lots of kind of small places. It was like doing the huge tour with Brian, and I thought it's a beautiful thing to have the opportunity to go and play the O2 and Wembley Arena and all these huge places. But we kind of almost afterwards we'd sit there and eventually go, it's big, wasn't it? But I never walked off the stage with the same sense of achievement as in some of the smaller places. I mean, it's still great. I'm glad I've done it. I mean, I'm not saying I would change it. I think it's brilliant to have had that opportunity. And I think it's still exciting when we do the next tour. We'll be doing similar things again. And to have the opportunity of that experience is brilliant. But it's an interesting thing that it's a very different sensation than playing to 200 or 300 people in a room where you just go, oh, the connection's all there and it's really working tonight and I'm doing it right and I'm improvising and I've found that thing. That is the one where you do, I think it's harder to go to sleep after that.
That was going to be my question. Is it because you are so connected with people that you need that, and a big stage is just too, you know, too generic and too kind of at arm's length?
I think it's also on a big stage, undoubtedly you're not going to be able to experiment as much as you might think you can. If you are playing to, and you know, especially when I'm touring with Brian, you know, I'm always aware that, you know, he's the name that's in the big font, you know, so I go on and I have to think about what do they want, and I do. So I still experiment every night and I will change it, and when we do our conversations I always throw in different things, and we always have moments where we don't know what either of us are doing. So I'm lucky in that as well, which is working with someone like Brian. I think we do have a level of trust in each other. I think the fact that we could do last year whatever it is 115 dates together and never argue. Occasionally we were both really tired and you'd think, I'm just going to sit and eat jelly babies over there while he sits over there with his wine gums, you know. But it was never like it was literally, now's just a time to go. Ugh. But we never had a falling out, and so it's still, it's a joy. And sometimes it comes afterwards. Sometimes it is a long time afterwards. Sometimes I'm going to a venue to watch a band, like going to watch Nick Cave, and I think, I played there.
Yeah.
I bloody stood up there. And so there is still, but it's a different sensation to the sensation of going. I mean, I used to love doing the, every night I did that poem about the den. That was, you know, almost how we ended the show. And then Brian would talk about, you know, the laws of the universe and how they mandate both life and death. But that every night walking on and going, I'm getting to do a poem in front of 12,000 people. Crazy.
And when we get back to normal, I do recommend people go and watch Robin for that very reason. That poem is gorgeous. I still think of it now, and especially now we're going to be having a child. I'm going to be thinking of that. We went out for a walk the other night and I saw little places that could, we go, right, that's a den place, that's a den place. Mm. We refer to you so much in this house, you'll believe it. So how have you found that doing the Stay at Home Festival and not having that audience there? Has that been tricky for you?
Do you know, weirdly enough, it hasn't. I think what happens with me is if I don't have enough gigs, but the adrenaline is all over the shop. But because I've got no gigs and no one has any gigs, somehow the act of being able to make something every day and have something to do every day has been enough. So I haven't as yet. It's a bit like when I tried to stop doing stand-up, and it didn't stop for you know, I still end up doing kind of about a gig every couple of weeks. But it was easier if I just went do almost nothing in terms of live performance. But it's that middle ground. Three gigs a week means that I'm, you know, that's why I end up normally doing seven gigs a week, or, you know, more than that. So at the moment, it's been, you know, I'm in a fortunate position that I had a huge tour last year, or three long, long tours, which also means that unlike a lot of the performers and a lot of people out there at the moment who are, I mean, in particular, self-employed people, I know there are people in a really difficult, precarious situation. So I've been very fortunate in that.
We're going to end on quickfire. So have you got a favourite colour?
I think it probably is blue in the end. Though I do like grey. Isn't that dull? But I do like a grey shirt. There's something about a grey shirt.
Yeah, I can see that. I'm always getting told off for wearing grey jogging bottoms and grey T-shirts. I think, again, for me, it's nostalgic. Because can you remember those grey sweatshirts you used to get at markets?
Yeah,
with
yeah,
really bad rip-off street hawk or something like that.
Yes.
That's why I completely agree with you. You've got mauve for this on my answer sheet.
Oh, yeah, so. There we go. I've changed. I changed over time, yeah.
Blue, mauve and grey. There's definitely a palette for you. A taste of naughty, something that you like but you kind of wish you didn't.
Oh, now, what will that be? Let me think of it on this one. I wonder what I said at the time. Let me just think.
I completely agree.
It is cheese. It is, yeah, it is cheese. I eat too much cheese. Because I don't eat meat, but I am a vegetarian, not a vegan, and I have, and there's a point where sometimes you stop eating cheese, and then when you go back you go, this is ridiculous, why on earth do I eat this? It's just sour rind basically. But then after the third taste you go, but I like it. Yeah.
Any particular cheese?
Do you know what, any cheeses I like. Nostalgia cheeses would be a mini Baby Bell, but that's not ultimately satisfying. But a really proper cheddar. There's a mate of mine, Carl, who's become a really great radio producer now. He does things like In Town with Mark Steele, but he used to work in Blackburn Market, and he used to sometimes bring back this cheddar cheese that was kept under the counter, and it was hallucinogenic. And
one of those.
It was so matured. And you would go, oh, rubbish, but you would have the best weird nightmares. It was strong enough cheese to direct your dreams.
There's always those stories that there was a special cheese kept under the counter that had maggots in, and that was like the best cheese. And yeah, I don't like the maggot cheese. I'm a blue cheese fan, I must admit. Have you got a spirit animal, something that you just like?
Yeah, I like crows. I like looking at crows.
That's a good, yeah, perfectly. About a fairly local-ish visitor attraction.
I love, there's a Berkhamsted Castle. There's not that much of it left, but there's still the moat, and then there's those little bits of broken walls, and you can kind of, you know, go up to, now is it the Mott or the Bailey? It's the Bailey, isn't it? No, the Mott. It's the Mott, the top, tall
I've
bit.
I've got the very person next to me that, what's the Mott and what's the Bailey, Sarah?
Bailey's the inner.
The Bailey's the inner bit.
And the Mott.
The Mott is kind of like the
mound. Yeah, the Mott. It's got a good Mott. Yeah. Definitely, it's got a good Mott. I should remember that. It was the first bit of homeschooling I was doing with my son during lockdown. So, so the Mott, definitely. And it's a nice place. It's a place where I go quite a lot, and you can just wander around it, and there's not much distraction, and there's a lot of just the way that the plants grow around it, and it's just very beautiful.
Wow, that's perfect. I love a bit of a castle, even if it's a ruin. I do love a castle. Have you got a mental screensaver so somewhere? If you've got nothing else going in your head,
well, it takes us back to what we were talking about before. It is that recent picture of a black hole. It's just such a wonderful, just the colour of it and the sense of it and the achievement of it. The fact that, you know, human beings have managed to get an image of a black hole seems remarkable. So I keep
that is incredible. Have you got? Well, I'm imagining you have, and you've said here it's too long. But have you got a stupid joke?
It is. It is the one that ends with, now that is how you shake a towel. It's my favourite one. And if anyone who listens to this wants to know the rest of the joke, come up to me after lockdown and I'll tell it to you.
Perfect. Do you know how to make a chicken out of a tea towel?
No, man with a beard used to do that. Yeah, I've seen. And Richard Wiseman's very good at making a chicken out of a tea towel as well.
I'll take a picture later and I'll email it. It's easy. And then a revelation of something that you do in your head when you're on your own.
I sing to myself in a language of my own making. And sometimes it comes out of my head as well.
I know exactly what you mean, because that started happening to me. I've been making nonsense lyrics, and I'm like, did that actually come out? Because it's absolutely, you know, certifiable rubbish.
It's kind of speaking in tongues, isn't it? But without the sense of a deity manipulating you. You're in charge of your own nonsense.
Right, quick, let's move off before we get certified. have you got a, and this is the last one, have you got a starstruck crush, someone that you'd absolutely love to meet past or present?
I would love the artist Robert Rauschenberg. I went and saw his exhibition about 3 years ago, which was at the Tate Modern, and I just loved everything. It's a kind of thing that I don't know why, because it's so close, a lot of what he did, to things that I don't like, but it totally tips over into things that I absolutely adore. And I just thought he was, and every interview I've seen with him, he seems like he was an interesting man. He, again, very humane and just wanting to create. And I just really loved what Robert Rauschenberg, I think somewhere between Robert Rauschenberg and another one, which was also an exhibition at the Tate Modern, which I love, which is Dorothea Tanning's work as well. Both of those people are artists that I think would have been, because some artists, of course, you can't talk to, and some artists are so brilliant at creating the thing. And that's their conversation. Their conversation is what they've created, and don't try and. But I think both of those would be people who would have been fascinating conversations as well.
Perfect. And then the very, very last quick one, because I forgot to mention it, but a TV show, past or present, or a game show that you'd bring back if you could.
Well, when you said TV game show, I thought, and I do still love it, is Bullseye. I know it's the cliche, yes, but there's something about what that did that Sunday afternoon. Yep. 5 o'clock, 5:30. We always watched it 30 years ago, and watch it now. And I think it would also be an interesting thing, because like the TV show Mr. and Mrs., it's a real window into the society of the time. And I think it'd be very interesting to see what a window it would be now.
So don't forget, there's going to be a live Christmas Day special with Robin Ince, Josie Long and friends on the Cosmic Shambles Network, cosmicshambles.com. Tune in, I think. I've got no choice. I'm going to have to. It's going to be perfect. It's going to be the perfect Christmas Day. Thank you so much, Robin. You were just astounding. I knew that you'd be niche references and perfect pop culture references, and you didn't fail to amuse and, yeah, just completely live up to my expectations, quite frankly. So thank you so much, Robin. And as I said before, this is about chronic illness and lockdown and how to cope and survive, and if you do need help, the Calm Zone is there, campaign against living miserably. So go to thecalmzone.net. Their helpline is 0800 585 858. Their web chat is available, and don't forget to donate. And some thank you to so much for Gist of Jazz for the music. Thank you to my name is Andy Artwork, John and Nikki, the producers that helped and do so much on this. Thank you for listening. If you can subscribe and all that sort of thing, because season 2 is coming. I had some delays on it because of various reasons, one of them being a baby. Yeah, I'm a father now, God help us. So I think that's a good enough excuse to why I was a little bit delayed on releasing season 2, but it's all recorded. I've just got to get it out there, so stay tuned. Season 2 is coming. Thank you so much for joining us on Summer Star Revolution from my bed. Bye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.